From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1975 when the Ford administration signed off on a temporary plan to help lower-income workers. That's because workers were struggling with rising food and gas prices, as well as other factors like a Social Security payroll tax. And so the Earned Income Tax Credit was created. It turned out not to be temporary. And today you're going to hear some economists referring to it as an efficient and vital mechanism to help people who need it most. It was designed to reward and encourage work. What does the evidence say about that? What should you know about what we call the EITC? I know in some ways this is a kind of broccoli discussion, a little wonky, a little down in the weeds, but right now with America focused on taxes and tax policy, we think understanding it is important. And there are parts of it that could change with the congressional tax plan. So let's talk about all of that and more this hour with our guests in studio. Berta Rivera is director of the CASH program at the Empire Justice Center. Berta, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And what is the CASH program? That's an acronym, but what is
CASH? So CASH stands for Creating Asset Savings and Hope. So we were established by the United Way and Empire Justice back in 2002. And we work under the IRS umbrella of VITA, which is Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, which has been around since the 70s. And so we prepare tax returns for those that are eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit for free. As a free service.
Very good. Thanks for being here. Pete Nabosny is Early Childhood Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Pete, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
And John Foote is here. He's a retired enrolled agent who spent many years working in tax preparation and many encounters with the Earned Income Tax Credit. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I want to start with Pete, who reached out to me recently and said, you know, with all the talk on taxes and tax policy, EITC is not the most glamorous. But in some ways, I've heard some of your former colleagues over at CGR and people in various places kind of extol its benefits. So on balance, you view it as an efficient mechanism, Pete? How do you view the Earned Income Tax Credit?
Sure. So I think of the EITC as kind of the untold story in a lot of ways in terms of anti-poverty efforts in the United States. It's grown over time since 1975. It's been expanded five times, I believe. And it's grown over time to be the largest anti-poverty program that the federal government funds. It's kind of pretty close to food stamps, but those two kind of go back and forth. And it's, you know, research has shown as they've expanded it both federally and at, you know, different states have expanded it on their own. Research has shown it leads to all sorts of improvements in terms of expanding family income, obviously, as part of the credit, but then, individuals work more. It improves infant and maternal health. It leads to better school performance for children. It's a tax credit that's targeting families, people with dependent children, and getting money into their pockets in a way that encourages incentivized work. And research over many years has shown that it's enormously effective anti-poverty program in this country.
Do you want to give a brief snapshot of how it works?
Sure. So, someone's in the workforce, and they as they make up to a certain amount of money, and it depends on your family size, but. But for a family of, a single mother with two children, as she works up to about $14,000 a year, the tax credit that you receive increases. And it's refundable, which means that you can receive more back than you're paying for payroll and income taxes yourself. And then at a certain place for that mother with two children, it's around $18,000, it starts to phase out and phases out at about $44,000 ultimately. So it's kind of hard talking through the numbers of this on the radio, but it's basically designed to get people working, more hours and encourage that. And then as it phases out, it still makes sense from a dollars and cents perspective to continue working. It doesn't penalize that additional work because it is phasing out at a kind of a gradual level.
Okay, so one of the common criticisms you hear on certain tax policies or certain government policies is when there is a disincentive to work, and what you're saying is EITC is not in that category.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the EITC is designed to reduce that as much as possible. There's still always kind of anytime you start phasing out a means-tested program, yeah. There ends up being some kind of incentive against additional work, but it's designed in a way so there's no cliff at you make $22,000 a year and you lose this credit. It doesn't work like that. It phases out gradually, and so it's designed to help people kind of move towards more self-sufficiency on their own.
Okay. Berta, how do you view it, and how often are you working with the Earned Income Tax Credit?
So the VITA program is based off of the Earned Income Tax Credit. So we work with it, obviously, a lot. But I view it kind of the same way that Pete mentioned, in the sense that as people earn more, the credit becomes, they become less dependent on it to sustain their annual income. And I think that's the real point. When people make their criticisms, they're not fully understanding the earned income tax credit. It really is dependent on and encourages people to work more. But once you start to phase out, it's not because you no longer need it, but you're making more money wage-wise. So what you'd be making wage-wise is much more than you would get in a credit form. So it does work in people's favor in the sense of encouraging people to work and earn more income, because that's obviously going to be available to you for the entire year rather than this one lump payment in the beginning of the year that you then have to figure out how to spread out for the remainder of the year.
All right, so there's a lot of different prongs I want to hit, and I want to start with John, who had reached out to the program last week, knowing that we were going to have this discussion, with some of what you viewed as sort of the good and the bad, or maybe some of the holes or ways to strengthen EITC. So let's start there. What do you see here, John?
Well, first, I've got to agree with both Bert and Pete. The EITC is probably one of the most effective anti-poverty programs that our government has. It is very easy to administer. It's done as part of the tax return, and it does provide a significant benefit as you go toward the $14,000 amount that you talked about for lower-income people that are working. What I see from the experiences I've had over the decades is that there are ways that the current EITC can be improved. To me, there are four areas that when Congress first introduced the EITC, they failed to address. And the first area is what I call the main COCO, the confounding covariance. Pete mentioned this $14,000 with a long tail that goes out to $44,000. If you look at a curve, it's like a hill with a steep face on one side and a slope very low on the other side to go back down. But in reality, it's two hills. A single mother has a hill, a single father has a hill, and a married couple has a third hill. And that third hill is a little bit higher than the others, but if a family is headed by a single parent, they get two hills, and a married couple only get one. And so the unintended confounding covariance, the COCO, is that if two parents split up, they can provide their family with a significant increase in cash. So it encourages, in my mind, and I've had couples sitting across the table from me doing taxes and questioning why their coworkers got so much more money than they got for essentially the same job. The EITC in its current form encourages single-parent families.
So couples to split. They could make more money if they split.
Obviously, yes. I did an analysis in the 2013 tax season, and in terms of the father's income, the analysis I did found that if he leaves, he can give the family up to a 28% increase in cash that year. When's the last time you got a 28% raise?
Okay, so that is... assuming that framework is true, that seems to be an obvious place to go. Berta, do you see that?
Yes, we see that a lot. We actually have conversations with couples, and some people have actually told us we're choosing not to marry. And for that specific reason, there's more of a benefit as a head of household filing status than sometimes there is as married filing jointly. And then we see the opposite of that is when clients do come in after they have married for the year and they see the difference in the EITC, but their financial situation hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And so that obviously, is an opportunity potentially to improve the system to make it kind of fair across the board when you think about it.
Okay. And so when you look at government policy, I don't want to get sort of, make too many assumptions, but Pete Nabosny with the Children's Agenda, families in poverty, well, first of all, people in poverty we're likely to see more single moms with poverty, more kids in single parent households. And, what John and Berta just described is not a case where the couple has to break up, and they may legally break up a marriage or choose not to get married and stay, quote, single, as a way to claim more of a benefit here. But is there a concern in your mind about disincentivizing marriage, about bringing households together, and possible deleterious effects there because of this situation?
Well, sure. I think at some level, I'm happily married myself, and marriage is a good thing for a lot of people. And there is research that shows that, in terms of family stability and things like that, we want to have policies that encourage permanent caring relationships for parents and for children. And so, whether the legal status of a family is marriage or not. I mean, I think that the important thing for children is that they have two supportive, loving parents, ideally, and there are lots of situations where that can't happen. But there has been times that when we've talked about tax policy in this country, we've talked about, marriage penalties, and that's usually focused on and I'm sure John can tell a lot more about this than I can, but, usually focused on kind of middle-class families where it makes sense for them not to be married, but we need to really look at these programs for low-income families as well, as in terms of making sure that our tax code, matches the way people want to be able to live their lives and mm-hmm. supportive towards those relationships that can be more permanent and therefore more nurturing for children.
Berta, is there a standard answer you give if a couple literally asks you, "Hey, should we not get married? Is it better for our tax returns? Do we have more money if we just stay unmarried?"
So we do our best to stay away from giving advice.
Yeah, marital advice.
Our role.
Out of your job description.
Exactly. Our role is to empower. So if people ask questions, we're going to give them accurate information. Then it's up to them to decide what it is they want to do.
Okay. But maybe a fix to this is, John? I mean, to make sure that there isn't essentially a penalty then for that couple to get married, right?
In my mind, it would be much better if we were to do an analysis of what the total would be for each parent were they to claim head of household status, and then give the family that is married a credit which would be at least 10% higher than they would have gotten had they been split up. Because mm-hmm. I believe, and I hope research proves this out, that a child raised in a two-parent family is going to get a benefit in our society as opposed to a person that's raised in a single-parent household.
Okay, and so there's one idea. Let me also read, this comes from where did this come from? I'm about to read something, and I want to tell you where it's from. Here it is. Thank you. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities extols a lot of the benefits of the Earned Income Tax Credit, but has this section about workers without children at all. Quote, in contrast to the Earned Income Tax Credit for families with children, the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC, for workers not raising children in the home remains extremely small, too small even to fully offset federal taxes for workers at the poverty line. Under current law, a childless adult or non-custodial parent working full-time year-round at the federal minimum wage is ineligible for the EITC. Such an individual would receive the maximum EITC if he or she had children. As a result, low-wage workers not raising children are the sole group that the federal tax system taxes into or deeper into poverty. Pete Nabosny, agree or disagree there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, to me, that's the biggest hole in the EITC today is the fact that childless adults really don't receive much of a benefit at all. And in particular, adults under 25 aren't eligible for it. And I think as you're looking at trying to encourage more people to, young people, who are leaving high school, who may not be on a college track, or to get into the workforce and to, add hours and move up professionally, the fact that tax credit's not there to help encourage that, to show the value of some of the work and help them kind of get started as an adult in the working world, the fact that these childless adults who are in the workforce aren't eligible for much of an EITC, if any EITC at all, is a real hole today. And it's one of the things a lot of advocates like the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, but others have really said, we need to address this. We need to think about childless adults and how we can build out the EITC for that group as well.
How do we get here with that? Why would that be baked into that kind of a cake? That seems obvious to me as a problem.
Sure. John may be able to give a bit more of a history on this than I am, but the way I've seen it is, we look at the Earned Income Tax Credit as you have parents with children, and that's a desirable group to target a tax credit towards. And in particular, when welfare reform was passed mm-hmm. in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. that took away a lot of the traditional welfare benefits for you know, particularly, you know, single mothers with children there, you know, they added, it was a huge expansion in the EITC at that time. And so this was a way to say, we're changing the way we're structuring these assistance programs away from what had been done in the past, which was, you know, cash assistance towards this sort of more tax credit incentive model. But when doing that, they really thought about these adults with children, with dependent children, and not so much these, you know, these other sets of, you know, people in our society who also could benefit from this tax credit here.
Okay, John?
I have the experience of age. When I started doing earned income tax credit returns, it was not available for people with no children. And then the philosophy was that for low-income earners, when you get a when you work for $100 a week, your paycheck is going to be about 7.6% less than that at the end of the week. And that's because the Social Security and Medicare taxes are withheld. So one year, all of a sudden, low-income earners with no children were eligible for a 7.6% earned income tax credit. So it exactly offset the decrease in take-home pay that they got because of the embedded taxes mm-hmm. that were in their returns.
Okay. And how do you feel about, you know, workers with no children?
My history has been that the earned income tax credit was benefiting children or families with children. And I've got to tell you, it seems like it's a governmental creep to now take some program designed for one thing and apply it to others.
All right. So in your historical analysis of this was always about people with kids.
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. Berta, how do you view it?
So I see both sides, obviously. However, we do have a very large percentage of clients who don't have children. And for whatever reason, based on what's happening now, especially today, it's not as easy to make the income that you need with the cost of living and different things that are increasing and the taxes coming out of a paycheck. I personally don't have kids. So that tax bracket that I'm in the sense that I'm getting a larger portion taken out of my paycheck than others, you know, obviously people with kids, you need it more, you have additional expenses. But again, if the EITC was designed to encourage working and to encourage people to be able to pursue that opportunity, it has to be seen, I would think, across the board, because whether you have children or not, you still want to be able to work and you want to encourage people to work and not be as dependent on other benefits or other programs if they had the opportunity to work and there was more of an incentive as well. So it can be seen both sides.
Okay, Pete?
Yeah, I think at some point we need to think about how to sort of separate these two things out. I mean, I agree. I mean, it was designed, and it, clearly the tax credit shows that it's targeted towards, families with children. But at some point, I'd like to see us sort of separate these two things out to say we're going to have a refundable child tax credit because there's a cost of having children, and then a separate earned income tax credit that is, you know, sort of agnostic to whether or not someone has children, but is trying to push people towards work. But as we have it now, we do have a child tax credit, but not to get too into the weeds with this, but it's not entirely as refundable as the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. And so we've kind of conflated these things together, and I think ultimately, you know, we should probably, if we were doing tax reform in a different way and really focusing on mm-hmm. Low-income families, we should really think about how to maybe to separate out those unique needs between people with children and have something refundable for low-income families there, and then separately something to encourage work.
Did you say you don't want to get down too much into the weeds?
I think I did.
We are spending the hour in the weeds.
All right, let's do it then.
And that's okay, because, you know, this is a good moment for us to do that. And listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the earned income tax credit, how it works, who's eligible, and why, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You just heard Pete Nabosny, Early Childhood Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Berta Rivera is Director of the CASH Program at the Empire Justice Center. And John Foote is a retired enrolled agent who has spent many years working in tax preparation. And we are talking about how this works and maybe what it's designed to do. And again, looking at some of the analysis from the Center center on budget and policy priorities. If it's designed to reduce poverty, well, they say in 2015, the earned income tax credit lifted about 6.5 million people out of poverty, including 3.3 million children. The number of poor children would have been more than one quarter higher without the earned income tax credit. The credit reduced the severity of poverty for another 21.2 million people, including 7.7 million children. And in combination with the child tax credit, the EITC lifts even more families with children out of poverty. They've got all kinds of research to back that up. Berta, what do you want people to know about what, you know, what they ought to be doing to make sure they're taking advantage or you know, who's eligible, the work that you're doing?
Correct.
You know, what do you want people to understand about that?
I think the biggest thing to understand right now, you know, in 2017, most people know about the Earned Income Tax Credit. In the sense that anywhere you go to have your taxes done, the software that's being used will automatically calculate that in there, right? It's not like way back when and it was via paper and you had to know about it to make sure it was claimed. What our focus has been and what we've seen, especially over the last few years, is more so towards understanding how the Earned Income Tax Credit works and if you do have dependents, who's actually eligible. Because there is a lot of misinformation out there or a lot of assumptions that are made. So the IRS has a very simple kind of four-rule test for those to see whether or not they actually qualify as a dependent. And those things are, very first one is you have to be a citizen or a resident alien. You have to have a relationship. The person has to live in your house. So you also have to have, if you're a dependent, an income that's less than $4,000. And there are some exceptions to that. If you have a child who's permanently or totally disabled, whatever income they receive obviously doesn't count towards that. And if you have college students who are working and they might make a little bit more than $4,000 a year in their summer job, they are still eligible. So if they're 24 and they're a full-time student for at least 5 months out of the year, or they started in the fall and now you're doing your tax return at the beginning of the year, you can still claim that their income doesn't necessarily count towards that. And lastly, you have to be providing more than half of their support. So what we see on our end a lot is ensuring that people have the verification. So if you don't have the typical family, and let's say you're helping out your family and you're taking care of your sister's kids and they live with you, but you may not have filled out all the paperwork. So you haven't changed the address at a doctor's office or at the school. So if you do get audited because all of a sudden the IRS sees, wait a minute, these kids were claimed on someone else's return, now I'm going to audit you. You need to prove to me that they're actually your dependents. And sometimes things like that slip through the cracks. So then they did justifiably in their reasoning, they did provide care, but they can't prove it in the sense of paperwork. So it's ensuring that people know that. So if they are at that point helping out to ensure that there's information to back that up.
Berta, how do they contact you?
The easiest way to contact me personally, and I always give up my direct line, is 585-295-5732. You can always check out our website, which we've got current information. We'll be updating it as the year progresses to share where our tax sites will be. And that's www.empirejustice.org/cash.
Now, what I want to do is a couple of things coming up here. We're going to take some of your calls and comments that have come in via email. I think John's got a few more ideas on how to make it better or stronger or address some of the issues with the Earned Income Tax Credit. I want to make sure you understand exactly how many people we're talking about. The Children's Agenda reports that in Monroe County alone, about 60,000 households, Pete, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, 60,000, about 27,000 in the city of Rochester. So it's benefiting a lot of families in this community, and it's a lot of federal dollars. And we should also emphasize that the state matches the federal EITC at 30%. So if you get $100 from the feds for the EITC, you're getting another 30 from New York State, which a lot of states do that. So it's bringing in a lot of revenue into the community here.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. It's Norman calling from – Norman, where are you calling from?
From the Bronx, New York.
From the Bronx. Well, thanks for listening. Go ahead, Norman.
Thank you. I have a question about a question that was asked before. I think I just wanted you to elaborate on it more about the non-custodial parent and the earned income tax credit.
So what specific question there, Norma? Go ahead.
I just wanted you to elaborate. I just wanted to hear the thoughts about the non-custodial parent because I know you're talking about the people that don't have kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the non-custodial parent?
Okay, good question. Berta, go ahead.
So what you're referencing, the non-custodial parent, it's a New York State credit only. So it's not a federal credit, but it's something that New York State established to encourage parents who don't have custody of their kids primarily to continue to pay child support. So it's a very specific credit in the sense that it is considered an earned income credit, and it works a little bit differently than the federal program. So if you are providing child support through the child support collection unit, it has to be through the child support collection unit. New York State has a credit that's available for parents who are paying child support through the unit, even though they don't have primary physical custody of the children.
And what kind of a credit are we talking about, and what kind of restrictions or you know, income are we talking about here?
So it's a magic equation. There's not a flat.
It's a what?
So it's a little bit different than the earned income tax credit in the sense that there's a set schedule, right? So depending on your number of dependents, your income, there's a very specific amount that you're eligible for. New York State, to this day, 9 years later, working for cash, I'm still trying to figure out how that particular credit is calculated. But what you do, what people do need to know when filing a return is with that specific credit through New York State, you can't be back, you can't have back child support that you owe. And it has to be children that are within the age, so you can't be claiming earned income tax credit for 25-year-olds, for instance. And it has to be, like I said, through the child support collection unit. So if you, and that's one of the downsides, if you have a fantastic relationship with the mother of your children and you're contributing that way and not through the child support collection unit, you don't qualify for that credit. And the challenge is because when that information gets sent to New York State, they can verify with the child support collection unit that that's actually happening.
Interesting. Okay, John? Do you want to add to that?
No. Bert is hired.
Yeah.
She knows it. It's nailed. It came on, was it 9 years ago?
It came on a little bit longer.
But anyway.
Yeah.
I saw you reacting. You seemed to indicate it's complicated.
It's complicated. It rewards people that don't pay child support is all I can say.
People that do pay child support through the collection
unit.
Yeah.
They have to have not paid child support to be hooked up to this
Child support collection unit.
And then when they do comply and pay it, they get a reward.
Yeah.
Okay. Norman, does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. Norman calling from the Bronx. If you've got questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let's get our only break of the hour. When we come back, we will talk about what the congressional tax bill might do with the earned income tax credit, if anything. So we'll talk briefly about that. We got an email from a listener who wants to know, based on the discussion they've heard this hour, does it encourage single women to have children. Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk about the financial aspects of that and more with our guests. So earned income tax credit, answering your questions and more on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we are going to interrupt our regularly scheduled programming so you can hear President Trump's comments live. His remarks about Israel and Palestine, his remarks about the peace process, his comments about the location of an American embassy, and more. So you will hear the president in his entirety. When the remarks begin, we expect around 1 o'clock, and you will hear it all next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I want to just close the loop on some of the questions raised by Norman in the Bronx on his phone call, because I think Berta did a pretty remarkable job explaining something that's a little bit Byzantine. But I will also say, Berta, it sounds to me, if I have this correct, a couple of things about non-custodial parents. There is a state earned income tax credit for non-custodial parents, but unlike the federal earned income tax credit, you're not going to sort of automatically have this land in your lap. There's not software for that. You have to know to ask for it. You've got to have someone preparing that can help you with that, yes?
Correct. So you have to know, and that's why it's so good to go to a tax preparer who's certified, is you have to know to ask for it.
Okay.
One of the major reasons why it doesn't automatically calculate is because if you're preparing a return and you don't have dependents, it's not like they're on your federal form and then all of a sudden the software triggers, oh, wait a minute, there might be something in the state.
Okay. And then if you've got any back payment, back support payment, then you're not eligible.
No.
But if you're in a case where you actually have a really good relationship with the other parent and you're paying support directly, that you're probably not going to be eligible either?
You're not. So one of the ways that it works is they have to be able to verify that you are paying child support, right? And the easiest way for the state to do that, because it's a state credit, is check with the child support collection units in each county. So one of the other caveats, if you do tell your tax preparer, you know, I may be eligible for this, can you make sure to complete the form? The form very specifically asks for the names of the children's, the birthdays, and the Social Security numbers. Now, not everyone has a great relationship in the sense of being able to know their children's Social Security number. Not a bad thing. So although it's on the form, if you know it, great. If you don't know the Social Security number, it doesn't mean that you can't get the credit. It's just going to take longer for them to verify.
Okay. And from John Foote's perspective, you think this does this sort of reward, in your words, bad behavior?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the state would say, well, we've got to track this somehow. This is the easiest way for us to track it. But you're saying the byproduct of that is, you know, people who don't have good relationships with other parents may end up more rewarded than somebody who's doing absolutely the best they can as a non-custodial parent.
Yes.
Okay. And now, on the state level, Pete Nabosny, are there other things we should know about the Earned Income Tax Credit? Because, again, EITC is generally, when we talk about it, we're talking about a federal program. Mm-hmm. What about state?
Yeah, most people think about it as a federal program, and certainly the federal government's the biggest funder of the EITC. Most states who have chosen to match the EITC in one way or another match, you know, sometimes it's a couple percent of the federal to, you know, upwards of about 40% in Washington, D.C. New York State matches the federal EITC to 30%. So as I said before, if you're let's say if you're getting $1,000 EITC, you're going to get $300 from New York State, which, you know, is a substantial amount. But you know, the Children's Agenda, a lot of other groups, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, have been focusing on, you know, maybe what can be done at a state level given the sort of you know, the federal picture right now. Let's say, are there ways that we can you know, advocate for changes in the in how the state administers the EITC, targeting certain groups like, you know, some of these childless adults, you know, young workers entering the workforce, increasing the match above 30%, or things like a one thing that we do differently in the United States and a lot of other developed countries, we pay the EITC out at one time. It's tax time, and it's a lump sum payment, which has its benefits in terms of allowing people to make big purchases once a year. But it also can, if you're getting about a third of your income once a year, it's a pretty hard thing to smooth out over the rest of the year. So a lot of other countries offer it periodically, whether it's paid out monthly or quarterly or things like that. And I think there's some opportunity for a state to kind of take on, be a bit more innovative with how the EITC is delivered to
people. You like that better?
Yeah, I think it's, it, you know, when we talk about low-income people a lot, we talk about, you know, somebody making minimum wage and working full-time or things like that. But for a lot of folks, it's they're working part-time, hours are variable, they're working part-year. You know, you work in the summer, you work around the holidays, things like that. And that's difficult to manage household finances when you're not always consistently receiving a paycheck. And a lot of families end up, you know, the holidays are right before tax time. So a lot of families end up going into some debt to you know, buy gifts for their kids and things like that. So if we could move to a way where the EITC was, you know, paid out periodically, or at least people get the choice of that and the option, and maybe we're able to sort of incentivize that, I think it could really help stabilize, you know, household finances for folks.
All right, so let me get Jillian's question by email. She says, how does the Earned Income Tax Credit relate to the present proposed federal tax bill? It's a good question. The only thing that I have been able to find, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to read the following, and this comes directly from CNN. The House version of the federal tax plan tightens up the rules for the Earned Income Tax Credit in such a way that immigrants covered by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program will no longer be able to receive the credit when their work authorization expires. The Trump administration announced in September its decision to terminate the program, which means those immigrants will lose their protected status over the next few years unless Congress intervenes. Is that what you're hearing, Berta? Anything else? Any thoughts on that?
That's what I'm hearing. I know that we were talking about this before the show started, and John had some other things that he mentioned.
Okay. That may come out of the federal plan?
Yeah.
Well, that's an excellent summary of what I found were the only changes relating to Earned Income Tax Credit in the two proposals.
Okay.
The Senate proposal differs from the House proposal, but both of them really just tighten the requirements for valid Social Security numbers in order to receive the credit.
Okay, and it's not going to be cutting back, the credit's not going to be eliminated broad scale. It's not
only for DACA and other fringe, not things that are on the edges. Yes.
Okay. So, and Berta, some thoughts about that? I mean, does that provision in that bill make sense to you?
On a personal note, when I take my work hat off, no, absolutely not. In the sense that, you know, people typically come to this country, when you think about immigrants or people being able to come in or children that were raised here without having a choice, right? If we are encouraging to work and they're taking the steps and they're going to school, going to college, getting a job, paying their taxes, because we're not giving them this credit, but they are still paying taxes, it almost seems unfair. In that aspect. And that's kind of just my personal view. If they're good enough to pay taxes, they should be good enough to receive credits like everybody else. But that's just my personal opinion.
John, thoughts on this provision?
I'm the same age as Donald Trump. I have so many thoughts. I can't believe our country is where it's at now. I think we should be trying to help children, help families, improve things for people all over. And I believe our country needs a progressive income tax. Everybody, progressive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pete Nabosny?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the group here. I would say, you know, as a separate point, you know, when we're talking about tax reform, and I sort of said this earlier, but just to reemphasize, I mean, there's a lot of tax reform that we could be targeting to helping low-income families. And, you know, what John was talking before about, the, you know, sort of the incentives around marriage and things like that. You know, a thoughtful version of tax reform would take a look at child tax credits and the earned income tax credit and a lot of these other ways that we structure the tax code to help lift people out of poverty. And Paul Ryan himself has said a number of times that he supports expansions of the earned income tax credit, including to childless adults. And I think they've just, you know, as part of this federal legislation, just completely ignored how to, you know, support lower-income families and help them, you know, move up, you know, and become more economically self-sufficient. So, you know, there's certainly a missed opportunity there, let's say, and unfortunately, a lot of the elements like this are actually kind of, you know, more punitive to low-income workers. So it's really unfortunate.
Okay. Now, Andrew writes to the program and wants to know if, based on the conversation he's hearing, does the earned income tax credit encourage single women to become single mothers? John, some thoughts on that.
Over the years, I've had experiences with clients across from me that lead me to have four real concerns with the structure of the current credit. One of those four two of those four deal with children. The current credit phases out for most people at age 19, in inner city, lower income people. So it's an age-based deadline. And to me, that means that the present value of the future stream of benefits that a person is going to receive for the earned income tax credit approaches zero as the person approaches 19. So for a low-income boy, as the boy goes through puberty, approaches 19, his present value to the family, the present value of the future stream of earnings approaches zero. So it devalues the worth of a boy. But I've had people sit across from me where the girl has a baby. And instead of the mother being the recipient of their income tax credit, it's now the grandmother who is the recipient. So the current system, in effect, encourages babies to have babies. Because if the girl has a baby before age 19, the current stream of earned income tax credit received by the family continues.
Hmm. Okay. Bernice, some thoughts on that?
So I have a little bit of a different view in the sense that I don't believe at the point of conception people are thinking about the earned income tax credit.
No, they aren't.
Right? I think the challenges, which kind of relates to what you're saying in the sense of not just the earned income tax credit, but also when you think about public benefits, with public benefits specifically, there is a cliff. There is a benefits cliff, right? And so the challenge becomes is I don't necessarily think it encourages people to have children. You know, I think it's one of those things that even if you do have a child, it's not like this earned income tax credit. It's just an added bonus. Now you have all these additional expenses with having a child. So it's not like it's a wash. It's not like it's a bonus that you get at the end of the year and your expenses are the same. Yes, I get the benefit of the income tax credit, but that does not cover what it is to raise a child in a year's time.
Yeah, so a couple of things here. So when Andrew says, does this incentivize having children, the credit that you get is not nearly enough to cover the actual expenses. So in that way, you know, to the extent that anybody is thinking, well, should I get pregnant? What is this earned income? I mean, I don't think those conversations are happening very much. But given the fact that there's a little bit of a disagreement here, John, what would you change based on your years in tax preparation about this?
Well, looking at the headline in this morning's Democrat and Chronicle about Rochester being the worst of 200 cities in terms of progress in school, I would change the credit to have school be involved. That for a family to continue to receive the credit when the child reaches age 5, the homeroom teacher needs to sign off that the child attended school and maintained educational attainment for the appropriate grade in school.
Okay. Berta, Pete, thoughts on that?
I think that's a little bit of a Pandora's box.
Oh.
In the sense that, yeah, I mean, currently right now with the structure in the Rochester City School District, it is overwhelming in the sense of all the things that have to come out, all the reporting that's required, mm-hmm. what system's going to be required in order for the federal government to have access to local school districts if that's something that's intertwined.
So you're saying the actual mechanism to do that would be cumbersome?
I think it would be cumbersome.
But is it well intended? Is this a good idea if it was easy to do?
I personally don't think so, in the sense that we, you know, it's very easy from a general level to say every kid should go to school, they should be there every day. Who makes, I think the challenge would be is deciding what makes them eligible. So if I have a child that's ill, right, if they're out a certain number of days, does that automatically disqualify them?
I would think there's exemptions for sick and ill.
Right, so the other aspect to that, too, is depending on the school district, we have so much, there's so much going on here nationally, just in the sense of when you think about bullying. Right. So there are different factors that can affect, and it's not just the parent saying you need to go to school, but there are different factors that can affect whether or not a child actually attends. And so I think there's more support in the structure of how school is set up to make sure that people, that children have the supports they need to desire to go and feel when I go, it's a place where an environment where I'm comfortable. If we were at that point where that was the case and kids were like, I can't wait to go to school, then yes, this mechanism potentially could work, but until we deal with those underlying factors that may be challenging children and families to be able to do that, I think it potentially could end up being a negative effect.
And looking at this from kind of the other angle, the research around expansions in the earned income tax credit itself show that increasing the EITC leads to better school performance for kids. And certain expansions, it's like, you know, additional months of school a year, the equivalent of, you know, $1,000 expansion of the EITC. So doing it from one side, you know, just say if we expand the EITC, kids do better in school. And there's a lot of research to sort of to back up that statement. And then, you know, my other point around this is the research I've seen, even locally, the data I've seen, I should say, around chronic absences in RCSD, a lot of it has to do with, I mean, there's a ton of factors, as Berta was just saying, but, you know, it's really complicated. And a lot of the parents who have children who are chronically absent, you know, struggle with different disabilities and things like that. And adding more burdens in terms of how we structure some of these things can actually, you know, lead to you know, adverse consequences. So I think we need to be thoughtful about some of this and try to be, you know, as supportive to these families as possible. The other point I just make around the point that was in the DNC today is that, you know, Rochester City School District is struggling relative to other schools with similar levels of poverty in terms of academic advancement. So even when you're controlling for, you know, poverty and socioeconomic status of school, you know, RCSD is struggling. So these things are really complicated and I don't want to put too much on the parent in terms of where we're struggling. It's families, it's children, it's community, it's the school system. There's a lot of different factors that come into play here, and attendance is a huge piece of that, but I think we need to be, you know, really thinking about the whole picture there.
I want to ask John about one other issue that he raised before the program began about some concerns with the EITC, which is that, in your view, it penalizes fixing up and renting out neighborhood homes. Why?
That's correct. The EITC is unavailable if you have an unearned income of, I believe it's $3,400 or more, and a family living in a house, buying the house next door, fixing it up and renting it out, it's possible. I know it's happened. In 1 year, the rent income is full and the expenses are low, and they end up having $3,400, $3,500, $3,600 of profit on that rental. They no longer qualify for EITC. EITC goes away if the unearned income is $3,400 or more. So the current structure of the EITC discourages families from buying the house next door, fixing it up, maintaining their neighborhood. It's a penalty of the current EITC.
Okay, and that's not something that you think is a super outlier? You think this scenario does happen?
I know it happens. I've seen it.
Okay. Yeah. Berta, Pete, any concerns on that aspect of it?
No, I mean, I think I'd certainly, you know, if I were the person making tax law on this, I would raise that. I think there is a concern about people who have, you know, massive amounts of unearned income. And, you know,
but that's,
you know,
a pretty low bar that John's describing.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not
talking about all unearned income. I understand about dividends and people that live off of unearned income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm talking about rental income.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just one item on the tax return.
Sure. So, yeah, I would support changing that, certainly.
Okay. Berta?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I haven't seen it as much as you have, John, but I mean, if that's anything to encourage people to be able to sustain their household, if that means being able to get income from a second home, absolutely.
All right. So let me ask John, and then we'll ask our other guests as well, how they would, just remind us what you wanted to take from the hour on the earned income tax credit, maybe how to make things better or keep in mind as we look, because this is one of those rare times where everybody's getting wonky on tax policy. Mm-hmm. We're paying attention to Congress. We're trying to figure things out here. And John, all three guests have agreed on some things. There's been some disagreement on others. But I think I'm curious to know, John, if you view some of these negative side effects as, a lot of well-intended policy has occasional unintended consequences. Do you think that that government is sort of clumsy in fixing them? I mean, EITC has been around now since the mid-1970s. Do you view this as just sort of the natural outgrowth of policy, that it's good over time to try to figure out, okay, this is well-intended, this is an unintended consequence, we can fix this, whether it's rental income, whether it's other things that you see as needing fixing?
I'm glad Pete's here. He has experience from the Center for Governmental Research. And to me, Monroe County would benefit if we could determine whether the ideas I have make sense or don't make sense. But I believe that we in Monroe County would significantly benefit everybody were we to try to serve as a test case and take a look at the earned income credit that a head of household would receive as a single parent and give a benefit for parents that live together so that children are raised in two-parent families. And I believe, regardless of the difficulties involved, that having two parents involved in the education of their kids and, being required to attend school meetings to have their kids go to school and having the parents want the kids in school, taking the focus of the EITC off age, but just having it available for as long as the kids remain in school, through college, postgraduate, no age limit, just that it. And enabling families to fix up their neighborhoods and not be penalized for doing so would be tremendous benefits to the society in Monroe County.
Okay. Pete, you're in the room. Berta, you're in the room, and they're going to say, I need your two or three quick ideas for EITC to make it stronger and better. Economists already generally agree that this is one of the more efficient programs we have in ameliorating poverty, but we're going to make it better. Berta, what's your short list?
My short list, I mean, I touched a little bit about it earlier. I think when you're saying this, obviously this has been around since the mid-1970s, and it's well-intended, but I think in the mid-1970s, the family structure looks different than it does today. And so we need to kind of update what those eligibility requirements might be, because it's not the traditional family for the most part, a lot of things that we see. So it's not always your own child that's your dependent, and you might not know all the quirks that go along being able to claim EITC for someone who's not your own child. So I think it's just kind of coming up to date with where we are as a country and how the family structure works now to be able to reflect that in the eligibility requirements. So across the board, it can be fair.
Okay, Pete Nabosny.
So one thing we haven't talked at all about is sort of the intersection of the minimum wage with the EITC. And one of the things that I've thought a bit about as we've, the fight for 15 and moving towards $15 an hour minimum wage, someone who's making $15 an hour working full time for a whole year only receives about half of the EITC that they would be eligible for if they were making less money. And so one of the things I think we need to think about at a state level is, indexing the phase out, where you start phasing out on the EITC to the kind of the equivalent of what someone making the minimum wage working full-time would get. So we're encouraging people to get full-time work and then kind of phase out from there. That would be quite expensive, but if we're really trying to get people, into the workforce and to be, working full-time and kind of participating that way, we need to think about the intersection of some of these different policies. The other thing, and this is just because I like data and measurement and things like, the EITC is basically ignored when we talk about poverty in terms of the poverty measure. So when you talk about 33% of people in poverty in the city of Rochester, 50% of children, that doesn't account for the earned income tax credit, because tax credits are exempt from the official calculations of poverty. And there's a lot of reasons why that is, but you know, if we are able to kind of include that into the measures, I think we'd have a better understanding of exactly who is really struggling in the community in a better way.
Oh, there's the music I was going to ask you. if we do a universal basic income, are we going to need an EITC?
Well, I think you could change the ITC to basically turn into one. Perhaps we'll get there someday.
This is one of Pete Nabosny's bailiwicks, and yeah. I purposely held back on UBI just because I didn't want to hijack the conversation. But another day.
Yeah. If you got rid of the phase-in, you'd have a UBI. It's basically the way the EITC works.
Pete's with Early Childhood Policy Director for the Children's Agenda. Thank you, Pete. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Berta Rivera, Director of the CASH Program at the Empire Justice Center. You'll find her there. Thank you for your expertise, Berta. And John Foote, a retired enrolled agent who has plenty of experience in this field. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you very much.
It's great having you. All right, short break, and you're going to hear NPR's national coverage of President Trump speaking about Israel-Palestine policy there and more coming up.